Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things, the show where we talk about After Things, and I'm joined by my After Things co-host, Brian Brushwood.
Oh, hello, beautiful people. It's good to be back. I'm sorry I missed last week.
And I actually interrupted both of them as they were stroking their beards. Justin Robert Young.
I mean, I don't want to create a wedge, a divide between us. I'm just saying, I mean.
Are you comparing your beard to Justin's, like your beard length?
Yeah.
Have you seen how fast he grows?
Yeah, Justin was clean shaven a few weeks ago. Like he'll catch up if he wanted to.
That's not it's not possible. Hair grows at the same rate, give or take.
It's permanently. I'm like the Fast and the Furious car that has unlimited NOS, dog. It's always full torque.
Now I feel like I can't shave so that we can science this and go. Like,
I mean, again, listen, I know where this, I'm just trying to cut to the point where either you say we're not doing ZZ Top or we're going to be at ZZ Top next summer.
I'm not saying that. I'm just waiting. We're waiting for the right moment.
Yeah. You're like, it grows at the same rate. I'm like, I have to think, like, when did I shave? Friday?
Last week?
I think I shaved Friday.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Gentlemen, we're not here to talk about this. Well, we could be. There has been a very interesting announcement. Netflix has announced in their announcement that they announced that they are going to buy a ton of content. I heard like a figure like I forgot. Let me see. They're doing a capital raise actually to increase the amount of money. But they're looking to shift the amount of original content on their network to like, let me get the number here.
I think 8 billion is what I heard.
That's the number I heard. And they just raised like 1.6 billion.
Yeah. They're going to raise $8 billion to get to original content. Cause they've been saying they want half of their catalog to be original content for.
Yeah. They expect to spend between 7 and 8 billion on original content in 2018.
Wow.
That's an insane amount of money. That's not big for like entertainment. That's big for like life. That's big for all of business.
So I'm going to give you an example of how big that is. Like I've heard, and I'm not going to name names or anything like this. I heard somebody said, oh yeah, I'm working on a magic project or for a magic special for somebody that's Netflix related. I'm like, oh, cool. Somebody else says, yeah, I'm working on a magic thing for this person for Netflix. And then somebody else, oh, yeah, we're doing some magic-related things. So I've heard of at least three different magic projects.
Wow.
Being done for Netflix. You know, and I think that because I know that, like, when they did, I think, the David Blaine stuff, I think that tested really well. And I think that they look at for the cost. I know that speaking in general, Netflix budgets are not what they used to be for some kinds of show, particularly reality stuff and all that. So it's easiest for them to – they can buy that kind of content and there's a market for it. You know, they can say, hey, we're not going to pay network rates, but we'll do better than cable. It's a very interesting space. And so the amount of content I've like the number of people I know who have had green lighted Netflix shows now, like I'm thinking like in the last couple months that I know, and they're not even met other stuff too. You know, I'm like with this production company, whatever, there is a lot of stuff coming out. And it's a very different paradigm. And I was talking yesterday on my Periscope session, people were talking about like act structure when it comes to TV. And I'm explaining like you gotta be specific what you mean on TV. There's broadcast television, which is an hour is really 40 minutes. There's acts are structured around commercial breaks. Then you have cable, which can be a little bit different. And then you can have cable like HBO where there's no breaks. And a show can be an hour long. And you talk about Netflix where things are often, you know, I know what I'm going to be doing October 27th to October 28th.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you didn't know, then you haven't gone to Netflix.com recently because they're announcing here's what you'll be doing in exactly 3 days, 16 hours and 42 minutes from now.
Yeah. Stranger Things too. So, you know, that's
Get Down.
The Get Down.
So and they did some things where they did like, you know, things like the Get Down where they paid you know, $10-15 million per episode, did that. And that, you know, and that was sort of, it's kind of interesting because Netflix last year, you know, in 2016, they had a couple high profile shows they spend a lot of money on, particularly like The Get Down, et cetera. Stranger Things wasn't nowhere near the budget those shows had. And now Stranger Things has become this incredibly big phenomenon now.
And well deserved too. I mean, it truly is an extraordinary piece of storytelling that really does, you know, it hits all four quadrants.
Here's the thing that Bryce just highlighted. In 2016, Netflix spent $5 billion on original programming. Five of the 10 shows people searched for most often last year are Netflix originals, company officials said. So, I mean, to give you an idea, so they're looking to create 1,000 hours of content. That's what they did before. So, I mean, that's, you know, the half of all shows that we like are on Netflix.
Yeah. So much of where all other revenue could be generated is from original, wholly owned original properties. You know, if you've looked at the marketing or just the merch spend and the deals that they're making for Stranger Things, it's hard to not look at that and say, wow, that's an entire untapped resource for them to create shows that, you know, are not necessarily are like toyetic in the way that you would think of movies, but certainly in for demographics that want to buy things with these properties on them. You know, those are entire businesses they can get into.
Do you think that they're going to be able to resist the urge to monetize with like ad placement or place products or I don't know. For all I know, maybe they're already doing that. But by and large, I perceive the Netflix original library as being straight up, we're paying for Netflix. Netflix is paying for content. It's that pure artistic ecosystem that we want to believe in. Do you think it stays that way or does it start to devolve?
Well, it's not an artistic reason that they do it necessarily. It can be part of it. It is commercial in the sense that you watch Netflix, you don't get commercials. You pay, I'm paying for this, and I don't get that. And that's part of what's differentiated them from Hulu and other platforms is that, you know, the ads and stuff that go in front of things. And they do their own, they'll do some promos and stuff for other content there. But, you know, I get frustrated when I want to watch, you know, something on Amazon Prime and I got to jump through a commercial from whatever because Amazon's trying to leverage this. Netflix to me is the clean. The thing that annoys me now about the Netflix on my Apple TV, though, is how they autoplay stuff. When I just kind of want to browse and I don't want to have like, you know, them do the little trailers for each show, sure. But I get shouting why they're doing this, but I don't think that would be a good idea. I don't think they think it would be a good idea. Who knows 10 years from now what they decide to do. Oh, we're going to do a Netflix Lite because we have so much, you know, if they get to a certain point of penetration of audience and they know the rest of the audience is not going to come on board at any price, then maybe they do a, you know, an ad, you know, Netflix with ads version. I don't know. But I think
is what you're saying that it's not necessarily the ads. It's more that Coke's going to pay to make sure that everybody in the scene is drinking Cokes with the labels out.
Yeah, that's where I feel like if there's a compromise shift, that's where it's going to be. Not so much in that they're doing pre-rolls for...
But even then, I almost feel like that comes at a point where Netflix wants to continue to scale out how much original stuff they have, and maybe there now becomes far different tiers of like, all right, well, this gets this amount of budget. You can do whatever you want with this amount of money. But if you really want to make it seem you want to stretch that dollar even further, then we'll okay that, you know, your dog detective only uses Yahoo to search for things.
And Bing.
So apparently there already are product placement in things like Netflix. Or we'll see. I'm looking at some of the things because like I'm seeing there's a co-production show that's an ABC show, but then they're like, oh, it's on Netflix too. Well, that doesn't mean that Netflix produced it. So let's see this.
Really encouraging to hear because if they are already doing it, I feel like in my experience, they're doing it in such a way that's not intrusive, not like as you'll hear Red Letter Media deride Sony Pictures for its crassness in that regard.
So here's some examples. BEN, which is owned by Bill Gates, places products and TV shows, streaming content, and digital influencers. The company did over 6,000 placements last year, including Dunkin' Donuts and GM into House of Cards. Tin Cup Whiskey and Jessica Jones and Jose Cuervo in Fuller House.
Hmm.
So
weird. I don't even remember those House of Cards ones.
Yeah, I mean,
Diddy and Your Company in a Netflix or Amazon show can cost between $50,000 to $500,000 per episode.
Wow.
Well, and I guess the question there is, it seems like Netflix has a little bit more of that leverage where it's like, all right, we'll take your money, but here's what you get. A visible Dunkin' Donuts behind Frank Underwood while he threatens somebody not to release the pictures, and not Frank Underwood walking in and saying, meet me at the Dunkin' Donuts. I'll be in the back by the Frappuccino cups. Like,
America runs on me. I'm Frank Underwood.
So you'll get, and you know, part of it too is a lot of these deals are often co-productions where Netflix doesn't pay for the whole thing entirely. They pay for 50% or X part of it. And in a co-production deal, you might get some financing from, because we do product placement, and there's already product placement in movies and things like that. But yeah, I think that there's going to be a balance there. And you would hear like broadcasters would get breathless about the idea of like, oh, and you know, you could watch the latest episode of The Good Wife with your app open. And if you like that gown, you could click on it and then you could buy it. And it's like, what are you trying to create? Like, you're not creating a product for people to really consume. You're just trying to figure out how we can take our pricing gun and stick it on everything and just end up making a crappy product. By the way, any product placement that ever come in a possible naturalist television show, I fully endorse. So,
America runs on the naturalist.
Yeah. So I think that it's exciting, but it's also a very interesting era that we're in, and where the way things promote, the way things move, Netflix has this advantage that Netflix is this brand, and they've got a really good brand. Amazon Prime has been trying, but a lot of their shows have just been misses. They're doing a new slate. We talked about this before. They're going to try to make Ringworld into a series. They're going to do some other amazing properties. They want their own Game of Thrones. They want their own defining thing. Amazon tried their own approach towards metrics, but I think the problem was is that they just – I think it came across kind of like engineers who were kind of very dismissive of how certain things work to some degrees. You know, like, oh, we'll just test market the script. And if people like the script, then we'll test market a read through, and then we'll test market the read through, and then we'll fully fund it to go to series. And it's like, there's a lot of things in there that are kind of a lot more messy as far as how it's made. And Netflix.
And specifically, it's the fact that you can only press certain buttons once. But the mere fact of having done it reduces the ability to do it again. You know, you might have a modified version of that where the audience gets to vote once, and then there's radio silence, and then out comes fully formed stuff that they had a meaningful impact in helping to shape and create. Whereas, you know, letting them vote on every part of the ride makes it not fun for them.
You know, the whole pilot system, you know, remember, it was really, really messy with the Zombieland creators where, you know, they did a pilot that people weren't super fond of. And so it turned into this, you know, shouting match to the public with the Zombieland guys. And, you know, there's been a few other pilots that probably weren't the best, but they had famous names in them. And so they just got watched more, and therefore they got more votes. And I don't know if it has proven out to be the best way to find original programming.
Yeah, that system would not have brought you Stranger Things.
Correct.
Yeah. That system would not have brought that. It just, there was no way that would have worked there. And then the Stranger Things, by the way, too, was an evolution of where they started from. They start, like, they talked about House of Cards. They did that because, hey, people like Kevin Spacey movies. Hey, David Fincher's really great. Hey, let's take some of this data we know. We think that Kevin Spacey is, you know, an underrated actor with a lot of potential for episodic. We think David Fincher could bring this element to it, and some other showrunners were involved with it. You know, Stranger Things was sort of a bet on, you know, the directors and the showrunner for it to say that we think they're a quality team. We think they could do something great. And gosh, they did, you know. And then you take a look at like something like Iron Fist, which was like one of the lowest, you know, one of the lowest rated Netflix shows ever, which looked like a bit of a misfire. But don't worry, that showrunner went on to go create The Inhumans.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well, off to network television with you.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much more that goes on behind the scenes, too. And I don't mean to pick on anybody. I should not do that. But it is this, you know, it's hard, and you don't know, like, it's a town where people don't necessarily know why something's a success. You know, they'll go look at, like, Stranger Things, it's those great kids they had, it's Winona Ryder. And it's like, I think it comes back down to the direction and the writing, and then every other decision stems off from there. If you don't have good writing, the best direction in the world can't fix it.
So I've got a question for the After Things audience, and it took me a while to kind of formulate what I had to ask and phrase it in a way that would be generic enough so that we're not talking about any specific projects. But in general, do you guys have any tactics or habits that you employ to manage the time when a project that you care deeply about is in a bit of a holding pattern? Because by this point, all three of us have had various projects that are very, you know, there's go, go, go times. And then there's, well, you're going to have to wait 2 to 3 months until it's the right time to pitch or the right season for X, Y, or until this project comes out. How do you guys manage that waiting time? Because I don't think any of us especially loves taking it easy.
My answer was, I went through that when I was first trying to pitch my own television show. The first thing I did was, when I first started pitching years ago, I realized I could go pitch a magic show maybe once a year. I could go make the rounds to networks pitching something, and then I needed to wait a year before I did anything else. So what I did with my producing partner, Mary Jarris, was we pitched other shows. So I came up with other shows, sold shows to Lionsgate. You know, selling a show means you bring an idea to a studio. They might pay you some money for, you know, to say, all right, we'll pay you to develop it, whatever. And then, you know, 90% of the time, nothing happens. But I did that with Lionsgate. I did that with G4 Underground came from that. I did that with some other projects with other networks, et cetera, where I would just go pitch other things that weren't magic related. And then when it was time to go pitch, I'd go pitch a magic show again. And like every 2 years or so or 3 years, I ended up doing a pilot. But when I got tired of that, always sort of like waiting, that was when I started writing books. That was 6 years ago, leaving South by Southwest. I was going through this holding pattern, waiting to find out about some stuff. And actually at a point where I was less enthusiastic about going out and pitching. And I said, why don't I write novels? So that way when I have downtime, I can just write a book. And that's where that came from. And now I go through this holding pattern with books where I wait for like, oh, so-and-so's got this option. They're going to try to take it out, make it into a series. Great. I'm going to go write another book and start a completely new property. And so I have multiple properties at any given time can be in various states of development.
What about you, Justin?
A lot of that experience with Andrew, I was there for, and it was intensely frustrating. And not only for Andrew, but also the entire kind of business, which revolved around Andrew's output. So all that was very kind of instructive for me, specifically in the idea that I don't want to do it. And I have probably been too distrustful of kind of systems that make you wait around. And so it's probably shied me more so than it should away from waiting on people. In terms of my own stuff, you know, I don't know. It's so hard to say, well, this is in a holding pattern when you're kind of doing it every week. So a lot of the stuff that I do just requires X amount of effort and you know, I guess doesn't necessarily put me in that same mindset.
Well, but there are there pitches you have out for things, like whether it's, an event coming up that they're and this is me totally making up. Hopefully I'm not accidentally stumbling into actual situations you're in. But like for where you are, I would imagine that there's a number of companies that are like, well, we have our corporate bleedly blah, and we're looking for a master of ceremonies, and it's you and another guy. Like, do you have any gigs like that that are just floating around waiting? And if not, are you interested in pursuing those big harvest opportunities?
I mean, I haven't. You know, and by the way, it's more it was more on display than ever over the weekend at TwitchCon, when all these people that I went to this Twitch hosting thing with a couple months ago all had gigs at TwitchCon, and a lot of that I'm sure was them following up and doing everything that you should and talking to the kind of agents that were there, and I didn't do any of that largely because at the point that I went to it, I was still in the middle of the Kickstarter and I was dealing with the injury thing, and like the idea of kind of expanding was not in my wheelhouse. Now, going forward, would I? Maybe, but I feel like my day to day is so jam packed. And again, there was really the number one lesson of working through that period with Andrew is like, you can't emotionally let somebody else hold you up creatively. Like that is a painful, annoying road. And you know, even if it's outside, if that lesson is outsized, because I watched it on the outside instead of you know, Andrew actually dealing with the his being the work that we were, you know, waiting on. Like, it was something that to me was the almost the number one lesson of how to deal with outsiders is like, always be the master of your domain. You are working on something that you control at all times, or else you will just let yourself be destroyed by the slow moving effects of other people.
You just don't want to be in a position where you're, you know, exactly that. Like I'm going to invoke his name again, and that's Elon Musk. And I was actually, I have a project I'm working on with an engineering friend, and we needed a part, not a very complicated part, but we needed a part last week. And we got together to work. We work on it once a week, and we got together to work on it this week, and we'd forgotten to order the part. It was just kind of a group. We forgot to do this thing. And, you know, we're like, we're in a position where we could say, well, let's wait till next week, you know, and get order the parts. We'll have it next week. And I'm like, well, we've waited a week, and that'll add another week. That'll be 2 weeks now, 2 weeks that we should have had this thing solved. And we're 2 weeks behind. And if we're only meeting together one day a week, you know, that's like being, you know, 3 months behind, you know, in the project. It's like 3 or 4 months behind of where we could be if we got it done. So I'm like, let's go to Fry's. You know, I'm going to figure this out. And, you know, went and was able to improvise a part that worked really, really well, and just said, you know, I know there's the way we're supposed to do it, but we're not going to do it the way we're supposed to do it. We're going to do a way that works. And it was, you know, and I keep, you know, I thought about, and, you know, this is my tiny little stupid thing, but, you know, there was a story in the Ashley Vance biography about Elon Musk when I think they were working on the Falcon 9 rocket. And they did a very clever thing, which was, in order to store like your cryogenic oxygen and your kerosene, you know, you have these aluminum tanks. At that point, they're using these aluminum tanks, not the graphite they're moving to for the BFR. And to save money, they realized that if the aluminum is of the right quality of aluminum, the right welds, you don't need to buy it from an aerospace company, because then it's going to cost you 20 times what you should normally pay for it. They sourced a company in the Midwest that made agricultural equipment. If you look at a fertilizer plant, these big, huge facilities for, like, you know, processing things and doing stuff, they've got cryogenics, they're building stuff, they're doing things at the same scale, same pressurization, et cetera. It's just not, it's for a different application. So they found a company that made these tanks, and they said, okay, we'd like to order a tank. Like, great, yeah, we think we can have this thing delivered to you in 4 weeks' time. Like, great, 4 weeks' time, we're going to have this tank, and we can start building the rest of the rocket. 4 weeks goes by, there's no tank. They call the place. Yeah, no, we're working on it. You know, we should have it, we think, another week or whatever. Another, like, a week goes by, there's no tank. Well, a few days later, the head of the company, and I'm paraphrasing the story, but this is the gist of it. Head of the company gets a call. It's 7 o'clock at night, and they're like, there's very few people there. Like, hey, there's a guy named Elon Musk here. He flew in on his private jet and wants to know what the holdup is with the tank. And they go, and they're like, he's like, yeah, no, this is really important. We really need this. We're trying to build a rocket. This is just holding us up. And the tank got done, and boom. And that was the level at which he went to solve that problem. The level at which he went to say, I need this thing. I will fly there and do this, because if I don't have this, we don't get to build the rest of it.
So I would love to hear you guys chime in on, I know that I think it's safe to say all three of us tend to, for the 10-year history of our three-way relationship, have always been working in parallel. And yet there are people who, very successful people, who do everything in series, or I don't know, maybe I'm making that up. Like, do you think there's inherently a strength to working in parallel versus in series?
I mean,
well, and by that, you mean working on a bunch of different projects versus working on one project at a time?
Correct. And at any given moment, you know, one of those pots is getting ready to boil over. Others of them are kind of quiet at given times.
I I'll get going to my time management, because you tell me, because like I spent Saturday working on that technical aspect of that project that I had to go work with. And so, you know, my partner came down to LA, we worked on part of it. And then Sunday, yesterday, I spent 2 hours, 3 hours writing part of a book proposal. And then I spent 3 hours working on a technical, you know, a coding project, interspersed with all sorts of, you know, things like that. And I certainly handle things in series. Like, I need to get this much done here. And then once I'm done with that, instead of watching a movie or doing something else, I will go dive into this other thing. But I have timelines that I know that this is due here. So I will do this much for this timeline. I'll do this much for this timeline. And I know that I can only do so much. You know, I can only, you know, I can marathon writing, but I can't marathon write every day. You know, I would just burn out. So I know that, oh, I can spend 3 hours here, 3 hours here. If I have to do a book and get a book done in 2 weeks, then I know, okay, I can spend 3 hours a day and it'll be done. So I work in parallel, but in a week it's in series or in a day, or I work in sort of like 3 or 4 hour increments.
Sure. Sure. Like, well, basically you multitask the way Windows does in time slices. Like you have to do one thing and then stop and then do the other thing.
100%.
I guess I think of it in terms of, you know, the plate spinner can only focus his attention in series, but he's keeping a massively parallel number of plates spinning. Which I think is key. I think anybody, when you ask what they're up to, there are some people who announce that they are working on a blah de blah, and then now their job is to wait to find out how blah de blah was received, and then they'll do their next thing. And I feel like the three of us are all cut from the DNA that says, no, the moment that blah de blah is in wait mode, you're working on the Joopy Joop.
I cannot say it enough. It is the surest fire way, like in the same way that being an entrepreneur and being self-employed can give you tremendous freedom and can kind of be in so many ways a hack on what is considered to be modern society and allowing you to do whatever you want and you know, sleep when you want, work when you want, and take care of stuff. The original sin of it is the wait. And allowing yourself emotionally to be dictated to by other people's agendas. And if you are not actively waking up every day and saying, am I frustrated with this? Is there anything else I can do to alleviate my side of that frustration? Then you are on the road to an eroded mental state, is in my opinion.
Yeah, I... You know, I'll talk to people and they'll go like, oh, yeah, so you have a lot going on. And I'm like, OK, I mean, yes, I do. As a human, I do. But there are so many sort of things from my point of view. I'm like, no, like three books a year. It's like, all right, at max, the average time that takes me to finish a book is 2 or 3 weeks. Right. So if I'm writing three books a year, and that's doing other things, not just that, but, you know, half of my day for 2 weeks working on a book. Right. So that means that to do three books a year, I need 6 weeks to do that. Right. Well, that leaves me with 46 weeks out of the year. OK, there's all the other little things that come in there, redrafts, all these other stuff. You add that. So let's take another 6 weeks off. Still leaves me with 40 weeks out of the year. And that's where I do these other sorts of things. I don't do things that collide with each other. I had an offer to go overseas for 2 weeks, get paid really good money to go consult on something that I might have taken up, you know, in the summer or earlier in the year, but I had to say no. I couldn't say yes to that because there wasn't one thing that would have affected my income during that period that I said, oh, I'm making money doing this other thing, but it was juggling all those other things. I'd say, nah, it would be disruptive to those things and the payoff is later. The Naturalist, I don't know if you've heard me talk about it, it's been doing really well. And there's behind the scenes, it's been doing well. And maybe I'll have something to talk about in a couple weeks, hopefully. But I'm not sitting here going, yep, I got this thing done. Look at this book. And I'm not even sitting on the fact that I already wrote the sequel and that's done and comes out in March, or the fact that there's two more books in the work. I'm starting an entirely different series so that I can, you know, while this thing's doing great, I can set up another property and have something else that's coming out while I've been talking about another property, a kid property, because I just, if I got time to sit around and watch, like, you know, binge watch 30 hours of content a week that I don't really care about, that I don't, doesn't matter to me, that's 30 hours that could have been spent on an amazing project.
Yeah. Well, in, there is, I remember in the early days, and again, this is a pre-internet world, you know, I had a 45-minute stage show and I needed to reach a bunch of people. So I would go and download lists from the Yellow Pages, and I would print out 2,000 postcards, knowing that I would get a 1% to 2% response rate on, you know, hey, Brian Brushwood's going to be in your area in Atlanta these dates to these dates. Would you like to book him for a show or whatever? It was very seductive to turn on a movie and stamp those and say, look at me, I'm working, even though it's kind of fun and I'm having a good time. And likewise, I would imagine for big projects, it's very seductive to a lot of people to say, well, I've done my job, I've submitted my things, and now my job is to wait to find out if I got the gig. And while it's very seductive, if you're going to have a grown-up attitude about it from 1,000 feet up, you're going to recognize that that's not the best expenditure of your time, energy, and effort.
Well, and ultimately, it's like you have to understand where recharging your batteries end. If, you know, there's a certain amount of mental trauma that goes into putting yourself out there and preparing how you're going to look to the outside world. Yeah. You want to know what? You should take the time to watch a movie while you're stamping your envelopes. Right. But at some point your batteries are going to be full. And at that point you're actively going to be expending energy, worrying about waiting, you know, and when you are getting too much into that, you know, flinching whenever your cell phone buzzes because you're, you know, looking for the email, at a certain point, that's always going to happen, right? If there's a big thing coming down the pike and, you know, it could happen in the next 12 hours, then yeah, understandable. But if you're just flinching whenever your cell phone goes off because, I mean, this may be it, this thing that might happen within the next 4 months, then that you got to occupy that mind, man. You got to spend those cycles better.
Dude, and I'll tell you what, man, you're talking to somebody who, after taking a week off to totally focus on the family batteries are 100% full. And I woke up this morning. I have not been this excited to be in studio for a full rock block 6 hour day of podcasting in forever. And all it took was that 1 week of being out on the road and, you know, filling those batteries. And now all I want to do is, you know, have these conversations.
Yeah. You need to have that, hey, I need to reset, let my mind go blank for a little bit. I'm a big believer in that. And I'm one of these people, like, I see myself as sort of lazy because I can count the number of times a day where I just goof off and I don't do anything work related. But that's why I work from the moment I get up to when I go to sleep. You know, there's not a point where I say today I'm done, but I played the Stranger Things game on my iPad. You know, I finished that, you know, and that was, and I'm not a good gamer. So it took me like 10 hours. It would take somebody else an hour to do, but I had fun and I enjoyed it. And that's over the last week. That's 10 hours that I spent, you know, cause I'll do, if I'm working on coding, you know, like I sometimes have to take a nap cause my brain just gets full up because I watch these videos, I go put this thing in there, and there's a lot of information I have to process. And from the outside, it looks cool. Like, oh, Andrew learned this, and print, like, oh, Andrew just learned this in 5 hours. I'm like, no, you know, I'm not, it's hard. It's hard for me to pick these things up, but I just have to be persistent. So I think there is that, hey, let me go do this. And my finger has hovered on buying myself a Nintendo Switch a number of times. I came very, very close to buying myself a Vive, you know, and just like, hey, become kind of, but just because the idea of it probably is more entertaining to me. You need that balance, but man, you know, there is, I'll invoke his name again. Elon Musk is building spaceships, digging tunnels underneath the surface of the planet. He's got an electric car company. He's building humongous battery facilities. He's building the largest factories on the planet. He's a human. He is an exceptionally rare human who has a very different way of looking at things. We can't be him. We cannot be him, and he cannot be us. But a human is capable of doing all of these things, and it sounds like it's an extremely stressful thing to do. But imagine what you could do if you were 5% as effective as he was.
Or better yet, just 5% more effective than you are right now. Like whatever you're doing, there's untapped bandwidth in there. As long as you, I don't know. I don't want to be the guys on the internet just wagging a finger saying everybody work harder. But I am going to say that it is as strange and wonderful to us what is happening. I don't know how to put it.
I would say this. Understand the problem you're trying to solve. When I go do my Periscope sessions and I talk to people and people ask me for advice, like, oh, I want to go do blank. And I've been thinking about doing this for a while. I'm like, how much research have you done? Have you spent 5 hours digging into this? Or if I'm on, like, if I'm reading the Reddit message boards and somebody's like, hey, everybody, here's my idea. And they get torn apart because they didn't manage. They couldn't bother to do 30 minutes of research to find out why it was a horrible idea. Or why we think that it's a horrible idea, and not that maybe there is some angle to it, is that sometimes people just, when it comes to creating or this, we just want to go, look what I did, or I want the trophy. It's like, check out the problem. You know, I'm not going to show up, you know, I did judo for years. I wasn't going to show up in a judo tournament and just expect that, you know, because I was determined that, and I got in the match, you know, I had to study, I had to learn, you know, I had to get my butt kicked and I had to figure that out, but that made me better at it with writing, you know. I didn't just sit down and say, I'm going to write a book. I tried that. They sucked. You know, it was when I said, man, I'm going to pick up a book. I get people ask me some basic questions. It's like, how do I do this genre? Pick up a book you like and ask how they did it. How did they do this? How do people solve this? If you want to be a podcaster, you know, we often look at the outside. I get people look at the outside of what I'm doing and thinking like, it's just effortless for him. It ain't. I probably work harder than most people at it, you know, because some things aren't automatic for me. So study the problem, understand the scope of the problem, and you'll find out that you might be able to get these things done a lot easier. You know, sometimes you figure out what is the right size problem for you to tackle that, and then your capacity for problem solving increases. You get better and better and better because you know the scope of it. Writing a book for me is pretty effortless because I know the scope of the problem. I know how to break it down. I know how to get it down. It wasn't like that before. So,
do you guys want to talk picks?
Surely.
Sure.
I got a weird pick that I honestly don't know how I feel about yet. And we're going to talk about it on Cord Killers, but I started watching the new Netflix, Mindhunter. Have you guys seen this?
Mm-hmm. I've heard, I haven't seen it, but I read the book that it was based on.
Oh, really?
Yeah. John Douglas. Yeah.
It's a bit weird from a narrative perspective because I'm having a hard time figuring out like who the bad guys are because there keep being characters that look like they're going to be antagonistic and they look like they're shutting this guy down. And then by the end of the discussion, there's like, yeah, no, that's great. That'll be a huge help. Let's try that. And then they work together to go forward. Like two or three times in the first two episodes, this already happened. But I like the conceit is this is essentially the genesis of the idea of the serial killer, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was the John Douglas, whose book it was based upon, was the guy that basically is one of the pioneers for profiling. Right. And his book was sort of him, sort of his, hey, this is what I did to establish, you know, to create profiling and kind of introduce the idea of how do you create a profile for, you know, serial killer. So Jack Crawford in Silence of the Lambs, the character that was played by, God, I love the actor. But that was based on, actually, I'm going to Google him, was based in part on John Douglas. So, I mean, I think that it's a very interesting story. But then when you talk to some people sort of, Scott Glenn, you talk to some people within law enforcement and stuff, in a couple of my books, I've been sort of critical of profiling in that sense, not like in the common term we're used to, where like, you know, like on the street, but some of these profiles, because there's such a limited data set often enough that you might find a pattern and decide that that's a norm. And there have been a number of investigations that Atlanta child murders, you know, were one, which I think that took them a while to get around to the idea that maybe it was a black person from the community did that. The Beltway snipers. Beltway snipers were a classic example of where the profiles were completely wrong, and the confidence in the profiles were part of the problem. You know, that was sort of the frustration from there, was that, you know, here we had these people that were, you know, getting murdered left and right by a sniper, and where had this, the profile was, and I'm not saying this unit was responsible for or was Douglas's fault, whatever. It's like, oh, we think it's a, you know, middle-aged white guy, probably on top of a service truck, you know, was a black guy and his teenage accomplice shooting from a, like a blue Caprice where they cut a hole in the back, you know? And that because of the confidence in the profile, they drove through police roadblocks multiple times.
Wow.
You know, so it is this, it's an interesting story and they have values, but they are, if you don't use good data to figure out how do you test this? Is this, because if you start looking at, like, you start looking up serial killers, you start to see there absolutely are patterns, biting, things like this. There are certain patterns to certain behaviors and stuff. But a lot of the other demographics about these things constantly change. So, you know, anyhow, that's my thought. It was an interesting book, you know.
This is a website that I've gone to a lot lately as I've kind of stepped up the 5-day-a-week politics coverage stemming out of the Politics, Politics, Politics podcast. And that is Axios.com, AXIOS.com. Mike Allen was one of the founders of Politico. Founded it, but I just think it's a really cool idea. There's always this question of like, all right, if you want to start a blog or a media company in 2017, you know, what do you do? And this is a guy who started Politico, you know, which would very quickly became a must go to reading place for political coverage. And he's decided to mix technology and politics in these very short, just the facts kind of, but you know, a little bit more effort than a blog aggregate thing. It kind of goes against the grain of like, no, you're going to read this stuff for the personality of the writers. It's like, no, you just want the facts as fast as possible, as shareable as possible, that make you feel like you got something out of the website. I very much enjoyed it. So, go check it out.
What is the URL again?
Axios.com, AXIOS.com.
Cool. I like,
side note, I just realized that the next time we'll talk to each other, we'll probably all have stories/horror stories of trying to pre-order the new iPhone, right?
This
Friday.
X gonna give it to you. He gonna give it to you.
So, did I do Movies Anywhere as a pick on this show or the show?
I
don't think you did.
But are you aware of Movies Anywhere?
Yeah, we've talked about it on Cord Killers last week. Movies Anywhere used to be Disney Movies Anywhere.
Yeah, so I'll do the plug for it here. So Movies Anywhere is a app platform by 20th Century Fox, Sony, Universal, Disney, and WB. And so what they've done is they said, hey, you know, maybe if people didn't have to worry about their movies being siloed on different platforms, they might be willing to buy more movies. You know, I buy all my things on iTunes. Like, Brian, you do a lot on Amazon, yep, et cetera. And that sort of can lead to, hey, I want to watch this here, whatever. So this was started by Disney. It was Disney Movies Anywhere. Now they're all on board. And so what they do is they have apps that are available for Apple TV, the iPhone, Android, Roku, Kindle Fire, Amazon Fire TV, and Chromecast. So if you buy your movies from Amazon, you can watch them. If you bought them on iTunes, you can watch them. If you bought them on Google, you can watch them. So it's a wonderful way to say, hey, let's just give you one place.
The only hiccup about it is that it's based on the partner studios. So like Paramount is still not a part of this. Mm-hmm. And I believe there's another big one that's not in it yet. But a lot of stuff transfers over, including things like digital extras, like outtakes or gag reels, things like that. I know some of that stuff on iTunes transfers over. So it's pretty cool. And I don't know if they're still doing it. They are. If you hook up two of your accounts to this thing, you actually get 5 free movies. And, you know, it's. I already had an iTunes account and an Amazon account. So it's like, hey, free movies.
Yeah, and it's... Yeah, I think that doesn't cost you anything to do that is great. I mean, that's how much they think they incentivize you to sign up for is great. So I think it's a great idea because I have stuff that gets siloed, and you know, I have some devices I use because the content's there, and some devices I use because I love the way the device works. So kind of a happy solution. And I'm glad to see they were able to get together. Oh, man, and something I forgot to mention, too. We were talking about the Netflix thing, and we can talk about this later on. There are rumors that Apple is going to be buying a bunch of real estate in Los Angeles for doing their own productions and their own development.
Yeah, that we've circled around some of those rumors on Cord Killers. I don't know what to make of them because Apple's been doing an awful lot of getting ready to get ready for, a decade now.
I mean, having recently been in the offices of one of some of their partners for stuff out here and having seen this is the property that they're going to be getting and to know some of the people they're hiring, they were trying to get everybody on board into like a whole Apple platform. Now the model is we need to be creating more content, and they have been doing that. They now produce shows. They did, you know, Planet of the Apps, which I don't know anybody who watched that, but that was an Apple produced show. They just bought the rights to Apple is now doing. Apple is producing. Oh, they're doing Amazing Stories with Steven Spielberg.
Yeah,
you know, so they're rebooting Amazing Stories with Spielberg, and so they're trying to work in Brian Fuller. So they're trying to work at a super high level. So that's a straight up narrative play. So. I think the problem was is there was this, well, we're gonna maybe do this, we're maybe gonna do that, and that kind of thing didn't get through. In the meantime, owning your own original content seems to be a very good idea. And you look at how, you know, we make a big deal about Netflix announcing that they're gonna spend $8 billion on original content. Apple has got hundreds of billions of dollars in cash. And a lot of that around the world. And if Apple wanted to start saying, yeah, you know, we're going to spend 2% of that, we're going to spend just part of the interest on developing original content that's this wonderful bonus when you have an Apple product or whatever. And we got Steven Spielberg, we got this, we got all that. Netflix was in a great model because Netflix says, hey, just pay us this flat monthly fee like you do cable, whatever, but we're not cable. You're not tied down there. We'll buy a bunch of older movies and let you watch those. Then we'll make some special deals on new movies so you know that it's justifiable. Then we're going to grow and we'll start developing our own content. And that $10 a month gets you some great stuff. Apple is trying to sell you, their monthly subscription services or their yearly subscriptions. Amazon's trying to do this. So it doesn't, you know, for them to say, hey, you know, we could, you know, Apple has the budget to produce dozens of Game of Thrones level shows and only detract a little bit from their marketing budget. So,
yes, I 100% agree. And the enthusiasm that, that you're feeling, I felt 4 or 5 years ago, for a different wave of it. And maybe this is the time that it hits, instead, but
they weren't commissioning producers at this level before, though. They weren't doing that, though. That would say that was the difference, is that now that they've actively we're seeing Apple shows and now they're ramping up on it. And I don't know if it'll be good. I don't know. I would say that I've heard anecdotally what the experiences were and working with more recently that side of it, and the outcome was not necessarily something anybody was really happy with. But this is the first they've said this is where their studios or places they're looking to buy. And then they're making Amazing Stories. They're making content now.
Right. And hopefully it will be like finally the dam is burst.
We'll see. I don't know if they'll be able to pull it off, though. I don't know. And that's the thing. Yeah, I don't know.
That's my question is, I don't think that they found. Like, they found the best possible person for Apple Music, and Apple Music still has problems, right? Like Jimmy Iovine, there's almost no doubt that he is a guy that was a top of his industry kind of guy that knows what cool is, that is still on the leading edge of how to market to the core demographic, and Apple Music still has problems. I don't know if they've found their Jimmy Iovine for original television production, and I don't know if any of the moves they've made make me any more excited for it, but hell, they got a crap ton of money and they're Apple, so.
Yep. Gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.